Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with none other than Steve Gradonis. We are here. This is the last time you will be hearing Steve's voice during Lent because either way, it would actually be the last time you'd be hearing Steve's voice during Lent because next Friday is Good Friday. So we won't be here next Thursday or Friday because of the Triduum.
However, I will be on the air, I believe, on Wednesday on a different radio show. So depending on where listeners are listening, they may hear me once more.
Is that on Catholic Answers Live? You're doing that?
No, I did Catholic Answers Live. Was that last week? I was just invited to do a spot on a radio show for Sirius XM for Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York. They want to talk about the Jesus movies in theaters now, The Young Messiah, Risen. We've already done that on this show.
We're ahead of the curve.
Yes, that's right. We are. And they're going to be behind the curve because we have one more movie to talk about that is only going to be in theaters one day. And that day is going to be next Tuesday, the 22nd. And so by the time I do their show on the 23rd, we will have missed the opportunity to highlight that. And that will be a shame.
Well, that is a pity. But we will talk about that today. We will also talk about the what looks promising to be. My son, who is a bit of a movie buff, said, I cannot I can't believe they're doing a remake of Ben-Hur.
No.
and then he said, what was wrong with the 1925 original?
To which, of course, the answer is nothing.
Nothing.
The silent Ben-Hur. Is it 25? I thought it was. Maybe it was 20. Silent Ben-Hur and the silent The Ten Commandments mixed up. One of them was 23 and one of them was 25.
Ben-Hur was 1925. And, of course, the great, great William Wyler 1959 version.
Mm-hmm.
Just shows that, you know, there are some stories that you can do again. So why not? And, you know, it's like saying, well, Hamlet, why are they making that again? You know,
I actually think that Ben-Hur is one of those stories that has the potential to connect with audiences today in a way that a lot of other stories might not.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, I think that it has the ability to connect with faith audiences. It has the Bible theme cachet, but then it's also a kind of story that I think has the potential to connect with mainstream audiences. I'm not saying that this will be the execution to do it, but I think you can connect with the Gladiator crowd and with the Passion of the Christ crowd with a version of Ben-Hur that is well done.
Yeah, and I've seen the trailer for it. It looks promising to me. I mean, you know, it's got the giant epic sea battles and the big chariot race and all the stuff that makes Ben-Hur Ben-Hur. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to go see it. And it's it's a bumper crop of Tales of the Christ this year.
Yes, that's right.
You know,
that's
there's. Right. Hail Caesar, A Tale of the Christ, and we've seen Risen, we've seen Easter Mysteries, which we're going to talk about next, we've seen Young Messiah, and now Ben-Hur is coming. I had no idea they were making Ben-Hur again.
Well, the interesting thing about this version of Ben-Hur is that it started out as a mainstream studio production. It was being developed by Paramount, and the director, whose name you may not recognize, Timur Bekmambetov, is...
that comes trippingly to the tongue, doesn't it?
Well, you know, you, you,
yeah.
when you... I always say I wouldn't remember anything. I wouldn't know how to pronounce anything if I didn't write about movies. But when you write about stuff, it sticks in your head. And he is the director of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which I have to say, I really I kind of enjoyed and wanted, among other things. But the studio has brought in Mark Burnett and Roma Downey, who are best known, of course, for the Bible miniseries, for the Son of God feature film version of the Christ material from that miniseries, AD, The Bible Continues, because they do want to connect with the faith audience. And that is not so easy to do as some studios might want it to be. I mean, you look at, you don't have to look any further than the very soft opening of The Young Messiah, which just did not connect with critics. It did not connect in a big way with the faith audience in its first weekend. But Mark Burnett and Roma Downey have had displayed remarkable talent in this area, and it remains to be seen whether they've really been brought in a way that will enable them to shape the material and to connect with that audience, or whether the studio is just kind of bringing them in as window dressing, the way that a lot of faith leaders have been kind of, well, it, in varying degrees of cynicism used by the studios in order to, as a kind of fire shield. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. You know, I was pleased with the trailer. And so I thought, I think I'm going to go see this. And I don't go to a lot of movies because I don't have all that much money. Anyway, I'm looking forward to it. When does it come out? Do you know?
August.
I forget. Oh, okay. So
yeah, it'll
be a while.
Coming in August.
Okay.
They've certainly, the trailer certainly emphasizes the action. They're definitely trying to, this trailer is definitely aimed at mainstream audiences. Don't be surprised if in a week or two there's a new trailer that's specifically aimed at the faith audience. This is the way that marketing is done these days. Although there is one shot that shows Judah Ben-Hur having survived the shipwreck, lying on a bit of wreckage that is very
cross.
Yes, it's a cross.
Yeah.
There are some signs, as my friend Peter Chataway has pointed out in his blog Film Chat over at Pathéos, that as he puts it, that this is not your grandfather's Ben-Hur. The violence is intense, and there is, first of all, you do see a scene of Christ himself. You see his face on the cross. The 1959 Ben-Hur never showed the face of Christ. It only showed the back of his head, something that the Coens' Hail Caesar kind of paid tribute to.
Right.
And there's also a bedroom scene. So you got, the man and a woman topless in bed. And that's also something that you wouldn't have had in the 1959 film.
Right.
So it remains to be seen, of course.
I remember William Wyler commenting. He says, it takes a Jew to make a really good movie about Jesus.
Yes. Well, there is something to be said for that. There was another film, of course, Spartacus, also from a Jewish filmmaker that was not specifically about Jesus, but dealt with the same subject matter and gave crucifixion a cultural and historical weight that it didn't have in a lot of other films. And Kirk Douglas starred in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
by the way, I learned something interesting a couple of years ago, which is that Spartacus was universally regarded up until modernity as the bad guy in the story. And he only becomes this martyr figure in modernity, which I did not realize. But, you know, it was kind of part of the function of crucifixion was to induce Stockholm syndrome in the onlooker, to get you to cheer for Rome's killing of your countrymen. And you see this in the mob at the foot of the cross in some of the gospel tellings, which I thought was interesting. And it worked very well with Spartacus. The take on Spartacus from antiquity until very recently was, you know, he got what he deserved or he wouldn't have been crucified in the first place. So kind of classic Stockholm syndrome inducement by Rome. So a little bit of a footnote there for you.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that too. I sort of, you know, assumed that everybody would regard him as the martyr, but the response, because crucifixion was such a horrifying way to die, the psychological effect was, I will say anything to avoid that fate. So people tended to side with the crucifiers rather than with the crucified.
It is interesting, though, that Jesus had a rather dramatic counter effect on that principle.
Indeed. And, you know, one of the effects of the Christianization of the Roman Empire was, among other things, just sort of inter alia, crucifixion as a form of capital punishment was banished. They couldn't do it anymore because, what have we done?
Right.
was the response of the Roman Empire, when it was finally Christianized. And so that's remarkable. And in a certain way, we're kind of seeing that now, in the church's approach to the death penalty, by the way.
And that whole subversion of the impact of crucifixion is a really dramatic testimony to the whole Christ versus Caesar dynamic in the Gospels. There is this whole political subtext to the Gospels and to the Gospel. It's in St. Paul's epistles. It's in the Gospel. The whole idea that Jesus is Lord, Christ is Lord. If Jesus is Lord, then Caesar is not. And the crucifixion had that power that Jesus took away from the Roman Empire.
Right, yeah. Well, we will be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Steve Gradonis. And we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Steve Gradonis. Steve is the owner and proprietor of DecentFilms.com. He writes, he's been writing for Crux. Now, Crux is sort of going away, but now has been raised from the dead by the Knights of Columbus, who have that power.
Well, what's happening is that the Boston Globe is parting ways with Crux. They're cutting Crux loose, so they won't be funding it anymore. Okay. The website was transferred free of charge to John Allen, and John solicited and found new sponsorship from the Knights of Columbus. But the Knights are only going to be underwriting the Vatican reporting and the Catholic News implications of Crux. So the freelance is not going to be continued under the new regime, and that includes me. So my weekly column is over. I had a good run. I had a weekly column for 18 months, which was a great experience for me.
Yep.
It's really changed me and challenged me as a writer, and I am looking forward to...
It's hard work doing a weekly column, isn't it?
You know what's the problem with doing a weekly column? You have to come out with something every week.
I know. Tell me about it. Yeah, I've done that my own self. Yeah, it's funny, you know. I like the Knights of Columbus. I'm not much of a joiner, but I finally thought, you know, I like what the Knights of Columbus do. So I went ahead and joined the Knights of Columbus, and you go to this meeting thing, and how should I put it? I'm not allowed to speak of what transpired there, and which cracked me up. And so after it was all over, I bumped into the guy who had like sponsored me into the Knights of Columbus. He goes to my parish. He's a nice guy. And so he comes up to me. He says, "So how'd things go last night?" So I gripped his hand and I leaned into his ear and said, "Hail Hydra." It was, gosh, I've wanted to do that all my life. So that was fun. But I like what they do. You know, they're the guys that are out there just doing things for the parish, doing things for poor people, and just kind of, you know, putting their shoulders into it and helping out and doing all those corporal and spiritual works of mercy you're supposed to do. And so I like what they do. And plus they throw a good, you know, Mardi Gras beer bust at the parish and all of that. You know,
once a year in my archdiocese here in Newark, we have a men's conference, and men come from all over the tri-state area. And this was the yes. So, not that tri-state area. I know what you're thinking, Shay.
I know you know what I'm thinking.
Yeah, we have this men's conference, and you know, there's this weird trash it every year. He's always talking about innators. I don't know what he's doing.
Do they turn on the Nightinator? But, yes, two minds with but a single thought.
Yes.
So, but anyway, yes, go ahead.
It's a different tri-state area, and we have this men's conference, Catholic men's conference. It was the brainchild of our Archbishop John J. Myers, who thought it was important to do something to strengthen Catholic manhood and Catholic the spirituality of Catholic men. Yeah. And so we bring in speakers from all over. This year I met somebody that you know very well. I met Patrick Madrid. He spoke there.
Oh, did you?
I did.
Oh, Patrick. Oh, that's right. I saw that picture of you with him.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Pat's a great guy. He kills me. He is so funny. He's just very droll.
Yes.
And I one time, we're diverting from our actual topic, but this is a funny story, and it involves a movie. One time I took a cruise up to Alaska with Catholic Answers. It left from the port of Seattle, so it was like, hey, you guys, you don't even have to get me an airplane ticket. I can just drive down to the dock, you know, get on the boat. They said, okay. So I went on this cruise, and Pat Madrid was on this thing. Mm-hmm. And so we're sitting there, and it turned out that there was a massive contingent of red hats on the boat. Now, a lot of people don't know what red hats are, but there was a poem that came out several years ago by some woman that says, "When I am old, I shall wear purple with a hat that doesn't go." And it was just, It was all about all these crazy things that she's going to do when she gets old, because nobody will be able to stop her, and you know, and all this. So anyway, this inspired this whole movement of little old ladies called red hats who wear these outrageous costumes, and they always wear a red hat, and they go do things like, you know, take trips to Vegas and go on cruises and stuff like that. So I'm sitting there talking. I get up one morning, and Pat's like sitting there checking his email on his laptop. And so we're chewing the fat. And as we're talking, he's kind of, his glance keeps darting up over my shoulder and kind of around. And I wasn't really paying attention, but I was kind of half aware that there was something odd going on behind me. And so finally I turned around, and this giant mob of red hats were all like standing around behind us, you know, and they were, some of them were already kind of three sheets to the wind. One of them came up to me and asked me if I was from Boston, and I said no. She said, "You look just like so and so." I said, "Oh, okay," you know. But I said, I was noticing your furtive glance, you know. He said, "Well, you know that scene in The Birds where Tippi Hedren is sitting there in front of the monkey bars?" He said, "I felt like that. They were just kind of collecting behind you like the crows on the monkey bars." and it was making me nervous. I wasn't sure what was going to happen next. So that was cool.
Well, the reason that I brought up the men's commission is not to tell you that I met Patrick Madrid.
Okay.
But I wanted to tell you that at the men's conference, we always have mass celebrated by the Archbishop, and there is also a Eucharistic procession, and the Eucharistic procession is the host is processed in a monstrance around the church, and I think that's done by the Benedictine monks of Newark Abbey. I think that those are the monks who do it. There's photos of the monks online, and if I have the wrong monks, maybe somebody who's Facebook friends with me can look at the photos and see if I got the right order. But there's also leading the procession is a long honor guard of the Knights of Columbus.
Yes.
So I'm bringing the topic full circle, and I put some pictures up on Facebook and Twitter of the knights leading this procession of the monks carrying the host in the monstrance, and they also had this canopy. They were carrying a canopy over it. It's very, very solemn, very well done. My comment on the picture of the knights was Catholic men wear capes and carry suits.
Yes, absolutely. It's what we do.
Have you actually done that? Have you donned the cape?
I'm just a first degree guy.
Okay.
I'm mostly there because I wanted to help out with the sport. I think you have to pass some level of something or other, which I don't understand because I'm dumb.
Are they
going to
make you vigil in a chapel all night over your suit of armor?
I certainly hope so. It would only seem fair. You know, because, yeah, I think we do all have to sooner or later, you know, get the suit of armor. I mean, I was handed the rosary. That was what I got for being the first level guy.
Okay, rosary. But I have to say, until you have the sword, I'm not that impressed.
What can I say?
You're not really a knight if they don't give the sword. Come on, Shay.
I suck, but I know the secret handshakes, and I know the special super secret greeting. I've probably said too much already, and they're going to come and kill me.
You're really more of a squire of Columbus, aren't you?
Well. I'm just a page of Columbus. Actually, I'm just a page of like Columbus's first mate, I think, is really all I am. So, but yeah, you know, and it's, you know, it's funny because the Knights of Columbus are you know, they're kind of stuck in these odd riptides of history. So, I mean, the reason the Knights of Columbus got started was because you had a whole bunch of Italians and Southeast Europeans coming to the United States.
Right.
In the 19th century, where there was this big mania for secret societies, you know, and a lot of them were anti-Catholic. So Ku Klux Klan and stuff like this.
Yes.
So the guy that founded it had this idea, well, let's have our own secret society. And, you know, who can we name it after that will help these guys become integrated into American society? So Columbus, right? So all of a sudden, Columbus becomes this American hero in the 19th century. And of course, now we're living in the 21st century where everybody's mad at Columbus, right?
Yes. Yes.
Because of Native Americans and all of that. It's like, you know, okay. So, but, you know, I'm sure they'll just go on being called the Knights of Columbus. I just like them because they're the guys that do the pancake breakfast and do all the good, get in there and do good things for people. And they, you know, help you, you know, they help little old ladies across the street and, you know, trim their shrubs and things like that. And I love that. So that was why I joined. But anyway, well, we've gone through another segment, so we still haven't talked about the Easter mysteries. We'll talk about that, though, when we get back. So you are listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Stephen Gradonis, and we will be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Steve Gradonis. If you want to join the conversation, by all means, give us a call. We are at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also text us at that number, and you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So, there's a show coming out. We talked about it briefly, and then we got sidetracked on the 22nd of March. So next Tuesday, called Easter Mysteries. I had a chance to see it.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
Did you see the version of it that has the extra footage at the end?
I watched it online, and okay, it was like it kept locking up.
Toward
the end of it, and so I finally had to just give up. I mean, you know, I thought, well, maybe it needs more time to upload, because mm-hmm. streaming video does that sometimes. So I left it to upload all night long and came back and nothing. So if there was extra footage, I didn't catch that part, but is this the extra footage with you in it, or?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Oh, well,
I am in this extra footage. Okay. So let's just back up and talk about what the movie is. Easter Mysteries is a musical stage production of the last days of Jesus' ministry, his crucifixion, and the aftermath of the resurrection. It is shot in a modern stage style. It's very minimalistic set. You don't really have backgrounds or a lot of props. It's mostly just actors in costumes that are kind of stylized to look somewhat in antiquity-ish, but not all that much. And then the stage itself is this geometric kind of staircase. It's an interesting construction, mm-hmm. and it really forces you to, you know, just rely on the music and the characters and the drama of the story. Right. And so in song and some spoken dialogue, the actors express their various reservations and concerns as Jesus proceeds toward his crucifixion, and then he's condemned by the authorities. He's put to death, and then comes the aftermath. It follows the traditional story. There is quite a bit of dramatic license and interpretation taken. Some of it is very successful. Some of it's very interesting. Some of it is going to raise people's eyebrows. Mm-hmm. I think it is very much worth seeing. Some of it I like very much. Some of it I found kind of challenging, but after I thought about it, I decided it was within the realm of reasonable interpretation. Mm-hmm. And like I say, some things about it I like very much. It focuses a great deal on things like conflict amongst the disciples and between the disciples and Mary Magdalene, on the disciples' doubts after Jesus is raised. Peter really bears the brunt of the topic of the disciples' doubt in the end. And I mean, certainly he does doubt in the Gospels. He and the other disciples don't believe Mary Magdalene when she first comes and tells them that they've seen Jesus raised.
He's unbelievably cruel to her. I was very struck by that because he's jealous of her.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that is a theme that has possibly been introduced into the story from the Gnostic Gospels, because the rivalry between the disciples and Mary Magdalene is a theme in certain apocryphal Gospels. Mm-hmm. So, but the way that the revelation of Jesus to Peter, even though it comes later in the story than I would prefer, is extremely moving. Mm-hmm. They combine Peter's first vision of Jesus' first appearance to Peter, with the triple reinstatement and the triple Peter's triple statements of love for Jesus and the threefold feed my sheep. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I found it very moving. And I think I'm always going to think about that when I read those scriptures again.
I was very struck by Well, there are a number of things that struck me. I was struck by the Last Supper, how jolly the apostles are at the Last Supper, and the apostles really kind of dominate the Last Supper in a lot of ways. In the early conversation, it's all the apostles, and you sort of get the sense, which I'd never thought about before, of Jesus. Jesus is kind of, you know, he's there sort of in the background and periodically interjecting, saying, because they're like flush with success. We just had, you know, this triumphal entry and everybody thinks you're awesome. And then, you know, love the way that you went into the temple and kicked butt and, you know, it's onward and upward from here. And so they're just completely clueless. And periodically, you know, Jesus says, well, you know, none of this is actually going to happen. I'm about to die. Oh, yeah, yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. And he's just like this. What I kept thinking about was Jesus, because in the gospel narratives, you know, Jesus is the dominant voice.
Right.
He's the one that's speaking, and periodically the apostles respond. But I thought you can... also imagine Jesus as the still small voice at the Last Supper, because we're told that the apostles, got into this whole argument about who's the greatest. And you do get the sense when they do things like that, that maybe they really weren't paying a lot of attention to Jesus at the time. And the gospel narrative that we have is hindsight, where they're looking back as they retell the story and now reflecting on the fact that they weren't listening to Jesus at all, because they were too busy figuring out who was going to have, you know, the seat closest to the throne and all of that at the Last Supper. And I thought that was an intriguing take on the Last Supper.
It is. And it's a useful and important perspective on the disciples' cluelessness. When we read through the Gospels and we only have the words of the Gospel story makes Jesus' words so clear, and it leaves out everything that could complicate the story. And it's hard to understand how the disciples could be so dense. But the reality is that these conversations were much more complicated. And right. The disciples, I mean, the story has, you have to say, it's been clarified in the telling.
Right.
Details have been sharpened, and everything that doesn't contribute to the story has been left out over the decades of telling between the time that it happened and when the Gospels were written.
Right.
And so, and the disciples, of course, had all kinds of side discussions and all kinds of other things. And Jesus had so many confusing ways of talking. He said so many things that didn't mean what they seemed to mean on the surface, that it's really entirely plausible that the disciples hear him saying things like, if these were his exact words, or words to the effect of, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. Oh, okay. What do you think that means?
Well, you know? We know on three different occasions he says this, and they do. They all stop and they're puzzled. What does he mean by this? And they certainly don't assume that he's speaking literally. You know, the one time that you do get Peter taking him literally, Peter says, you know, well, that's not going to happen, you know.
And literally, the Gospels literally say that when Jesus predicts that he was going to rise from the dead, the disciples were discussing amongst themselves what he meant by rise from the dead.
Right.
What it means to they literally did not understand the words that were coming out of his. And when you look at a lot of the other things he says, you know, I am the vine and you are the branches, abide in me, I in you. It was plausible that they didn't get it.
They don't have a clue. Yeah.
And that is something that comes across very nicely in Easter Mysteries.
Yeah, so I liked that picture of Jesus as the still small voice, the guy in the corner at the huge party where everybody else is talking, and he periodically tries to get a word in edgewise, and they're like, yeah, whatever. You know? We've got big plans, you know? And so I thought that was interesting. I thought that the rivalry between Well, it's really a one-sided rivalry. Mary Magdalene has no rivalry with Peter, but Peter has tons of rivalry with Mary Magdalene.
Sure.
And he is he's the classic, you know, insecure blusterer, you know. Mm-hmm. And because of that, he keeps trying to, which we see in the canonical Gospels as well, he keeps trying to set the terms for Jesus. Lord, this will never happen to you. You know, though everyone else deny you, I will never deny you. He keeps telling Jesus these things. And at one point, he makes the very telling statement, not even you could forgive that if I denied right. you.
Exactly.
And of course, the whole second act of the play is going to turn on the fact that Peter has Peter has no idea what he's talking about. But that I was struck by that, and I thought it was an intriguing choice. In the canonical Gospels, Peter is married.
Well, he has a mother-in-law.
Well, he's got a mother-in-law.
It doesn't specifically say that he has a wife. It says that he has a mother-in-law. And in a lot of traditional patristic thought, Peter was a widow, or perhaps he and the other disciples abandoned their wives. This was something that was thinkable back then.
Right.
So let's come back to that.
We'll come back to that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we will be back with Steve Gradonis and Easter Mysteries right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Steve Gradonis. We've been talking about a show that's going to be premiering in theaters across the United States for one night only on March 22nd, called Easter Mysteries. And it's an oratorio, I guess, is what
yes,
you call it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's more correct than calling it a musical, I guess. Okay.
About the Passion and Resurrection of Jesus. Anyway, before we went to break, one of the things that also I thought was an interesting creative choice is in the Gospels, we're told that Peter has a mother-in-law. There are various traditions about whether or not he had a wife at the time of the Gospels, or if he was a widower or what. But what they do in the Easter Mysteries is the young woman that he encounters in the courtyard of Caiaphas during the trial of Jesus turns out to be his old girlfriend.
Right.
His betrothed.
His betrothed. Right. So yeah. it was a degree of relationship and that you needed a writ of divorce to break off, just like Joseph was planning to divorce Mary when they were betrothed. So right. This would be one way of reconciling the fact that in pious patristic belief, Peter would not have been married. He would have been celibate, and yet he still has a mother-in-law.
Okay. And so he bumps into this woman. She's called Naomi in the play, and she's the one that accuses him three times, and she's angry at him because we were going to be married, it was going to be beautiful, it was going to be great, and then you got seized with some kind of weird religious zealotry and ran off after this guy to be his disciple, and what about me? And I thought that was really it was a striking commentary on another gospel passage.
Yes, indeed.
Which Jesus warns that a man's enemies will be the members of his own family.
And unless a man hates father and mother, brother and sister, son and daughter, he cannot be my disciple.
Right. What's striking, the gospel and the church have always been intensely pro-family. And we of course, we're seeing that today is in our culture wars here in the United States and the whole argument, all the arguments about marriage and so forth. And because the church is currently battling a world which is intensely hostile to the family, it's easy to forget that good though the family is not the highest good in the gospel.
Yes.
You see this expressed in the play, and you see it expressed in the gospel, that what's even more important than the family, as Jesus says, when someone says, blessed is the womb that gave birth to you and the breast that gave you milk, and he says, blessed rather are those who hear the word of God and keep it. Who are my mother and my sister and my brothers, anyone who obeys the word of my Father who is in heaven.
And so, Jesus' insistence on the priority of the kingdom and the priority of attachment to him over family reaches heights that in his day would have struck his fellow Jews as grotesque and even struck us as being really harsh. I mean, hating father and mother and that sort of thing is bad enough. But when Jesus tells the man, he says, look, let me bury my father first and then I'll come and follow you. And Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead. I mean, that's one of the corporal works of mercy. I mean, the obligation to bury your loved, that's really, really intense.
Right. And you know what? It's one of these things where we've heard it in the gospel so many times that we don't appreciate the force of it.
Yeah.
Until, you know, I say, well, you know, suppose it were your daughter and that were the Reverend Sun Myung-moon talking. All of a sudden you think, yikes, you know, that's, you know, you start hearing how that would have sounded not only to Jewish ears, but also to pious Greco-Roman ears, for whom the family was hugely important. And it really does drive home the sheer radical nature of Jesus's claims. And so he really is, he's exalting the community of the church above the good of the family, and everything in us just reacts with terror when we look at it that way, because we just think we've heard that kind of thing before, and of course the reason he's making that claim is because he's making an even more outrageous claim, which is the claim to be God, because only God can make that that kind of claim, and so it works out to be another evidence that, yes, indeed, Jesus does, in fact, claim to be God and not merely just, you know, some good teacher. He's making that kind of outrageous claim that only God can make, and that can only by the grace of God can a claim like that result in happiness and actually result in, of course, the building up of the family, which, you know, the church has always been a champion of. So, you know, when the church is founded, one of the sacraments becomes the sacrament of marriage, because the family is so crucial and it becomes itself a means of divine grace once submitted to God. But not submitted to God, the family becomes an idol like anything else. Anything that takes priority over God becomes an idol. So anyway.
So I want to say, Easter Mysteries, Tuesday, the 22nd, it will be in theaters. It may be at a theater near you. I do recommend seeing it. It's a production that requires critical engagement and encourages thought. It's not something that's just going to tell you the gospel story as you already know it, the way that a movie like Son of God would do. But I think Easter Mysteries is worth watching. It's an ecumenical production. It's something that Catholics and Protestants could watch together. You could even watch it. You could even bring non-believing friends and family members. I co-moderated a panel discussion after the film that included Catholic bishop, a Catholic priest, a Jewish rabbi, a Muslim chaplain, a couple of Protestant evangelists. There was a very interesting discussion. 23 minutes of that discussion has been appended to the film. So I'm kind of in this film very briefly.
Yay!
If you go to EasterMysteries.com, you can find theaters and buy tickets if you are inclined to go to see this on Tuesday the 22nd. So there it
is. I also wanted to mention, part of what was intriguing as well was the discussion of the Eucharist. Like St. John, the Easter Mysteries doesn't have an institution narrative as Catholics expect there to be at the Last Supper. But he has a discussion of the body of Christ, which is reminiscent of Paul's discussion of the body of Christ in 1 Corinthians 12. And 1 Corinthians 12 follows hot on the heels of Paul's discussion of the Eucharist. And so for Paul, the church is the body of Christ because we have received the Eucharistic body of Christ. In the video or in the Easter Mysteries play, not so much. But I thought it was still worth it's a worthwhile look at the Eucharist. We got just a couple of minutes left. Want to talk about Brooklyn?
Yeah, sure. Okay. It's out on DVD and Blu-ray this week, and I have a brand new review at decentfilms.com and Crux that talks about why this is such a great film. And it really... So often in writing reviews, I find that my thought is clarified and I wind up on it. And all writers find this, of course, that writing is not just a way of expressing your thoughts, but it's a way of thinking. And I went through all of the films of the year that were critically acclaimed or that I loved. And one after another, they deal with such incredibly stressful and extreme and horrifying subject matter. And you find something like Brooklyn and you want to hug it. Here is a film that finds incredible human drama in the ordinary stuff of human life and love and loss. It's not about incredibly terrifying or horrible comments horrible and terrifying things happening to people. And it portrays the church in a positive light. And it's just wonderful character drama and a great tribute to married love and just a fantastic, fantastic film. My favorite film of last year. Definitely see it.
Yes. And by the way, gentlemen, I took my wife to this on Valentine's Day and definitely scored many, many awesomeness points with my wife. So, if you're looking for a date movie, gee whiz. I mean, go out and get this, rent it for a couple of bucks. I don't know if you can stream it online yet or not, but you might be able to get it from, I think you can get it through Amazon.
Amazon. It is absolutely streaming via Amazon and also available by Blu-ray and DVD if you want to own it.
So, get the bottle of champagne, dude, and, and the flowers and chocolate. It's never too late. And
that might be too early in Lent. You might not want to spring.
Well, wait until after Easter, and then knock yourself out on the flowers and chocolate.
Yes.
Your wife, your girlfriend, she will love you. You will be awesome because it's a great date movie. So, check it out. Brooklyn. Steve Gradonis. I want to thank you for being on the show. We will not be here next Thursday or Friday because that is the beginning of the Triduum. And so we'll be taking that time off. We will have, I'm sure, a best of connecting the dots at that time. I will be seeing you guys next week. Until then, have a great weekend. Thanks so much, Steve, for being on. Our producer today was Ethan Boland. And you've been listening to Connecting the Dots on Breadbox Media. See you next week. Bye.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.